Welcome to Sitting Around Talking Movies. I'm Neil Rose, and it's the Talking Pictures Podcast, joined here by, as always, Bill Bregoli.
What time is it?
And Bill McCuddy.
I've seen the rundown. There's almost too much podcast.
That's true. And our special guest this week, returning to the podcast, one of my favorite guys, Jack Rico from the Highly Relevant Podcast. How you doing, Jack?
I'm right here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us on the Highly Irrelevant Podcast.
We've got so much to talk about. We've got the new James Franco film called The Disaster Artist. We've got I, Tanya, which looks at the Tanya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan debacle.
Fiasco.
Good word. We're going to talk about a series that's on Amazon Prime that Bill McCuddy and I saw called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which they're promoting the shit out of. And
spending a shitload of money on based on the two episodes
Bill
we've seen.
Bill Bregoli got an advance peek and watched the entire second season of The Crown.
Wow.
We talked
and
about
he's still awake.
We talked about Shape of Water last week, but Jack Rico wasn't here, and he's going to chime in with some of his thoughts on that. Also, a whole bunch of other things. Award season's coming up, the finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm. And look what happened last night. What a bizarre thing that happened. Was that at the 92nd Street Y, or where was that?
Yeah, John Oliver. Was it last night? It's been, as we're taping this, it's a Tuesday. So if it was over the weekend, I apologize. But yeah, I think it was last night. John Oliver, it was the 20th anniversary of Wag the Dog. So they had De Niro, they had
Jane Rosenthal.
I think, Jane Rosenthal. And
De Niro was there?
Yeah, De Niro sat there like,
wow.
This gave him an excuse to sit stone-faced for a reason. John Oliver started going after Dustin Hoffman about the sexual harassment charges from the 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever.
It was when he was making the movie version of the stage play, Death of a Salesman,
right.
And an intern or assistant that worked there.
Right. It devolved into an entire conversation about that was then and this is now. That was basically what Dustin Hoffman was saying. He said, he snapped at one point at Oliver, "You weren't there." And John Oliver said, "I'm glad I wasn't there." And at some point, a woman in the audience stood up and yelled, "Thank you for defending women." So today, everyone is arguing whether or not John Oliver went a little too far and pushed the agenda. And I've seen some of the footage from it. And I will tell you that he is asking very straightforward questions into which he is putting his opinion, like, "Your answers are pissing me off, Mr. Hoffman. That's not the way this, you're forgetting that there are victims here. You're not talking about the victims. It sounds like you're spinning it for your own good." And Hoffman got really, really pissed off. Never screamed at him, but they said it was really, really uncomfortable.
And we can watch this footage? Is it?
Yeah, the Washington Post shot a little of it. You're not supposed to shoot at the 92nd Street Y. They used to shoot them and release them. I'm not sure this one
will. Bill or Jack, did you see any of this stuff?
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I started looking for the audio that supposedly CNN had, and none of them directed to a link. So I haven't seen footage or heard the audio, but I've seen the transcripts of it. Now, if you ask me my personal opinion, I've moderated these before, and I'm sure all of us have moderated at some point a lot of these panels. The function is to talk about the topic at hand, but because he's a journalist on his HBO show, and I'm not sure how much of this was to get some sort of relevance or whatever, or it really did piss him off that Dustin had not been sort of been the focal point of all this sexual harassment and decided to tackle it on his own, I do think he went a little too far. This wasn't the platform for him to do that. The fact that he did it and got away with it, I think, must have pissed off a lot of the people that hired him to do that.
Did you think that Colbert – I watched this last night. Did you think that Colbert did a good job of interviewing Billy Bush? It's the first Billy Bush interview since
– I didn't see that, was it? But I know that he just – I know he said enough is enough. Come on, Mr. President. You know you said
that.
Well,
he wrote,
an
editorial that was in the Times.
I saw it.
And basically, Colbert pulled out the editorial, kind of said to readers, "It's very good, viewers, it's very good, you should read this." And it was kind of a reiteration of what he wrote in the editorial, kind of saying that he thought that
Billy
Trump,
Bush, you're talking about, wrote this editorial.
And Billy Bush was saying that he thought that Trump was kind of doing a performance on the bus, that he wasn't taking it seriously. That's his defense of of Billy Bush's defense of his behavior. Had he thought that it was real, that he was really, you know, doing these things, he would have reported it to the cops and the FBI.
Let's not forget that Billy Bush is looking for a career resurrection.
Everybody was kissing Trump's ass back in 2005 when that bus thing was done because he was making so much money for NBC on The Apprentice. So everybody was joking around and going along with him on the bus. But his defense is that he didn't think he was being that Trump was being serious. He thought he was just kind of just goofing around. That's what Billy Bush said.
Right.
So I don't know. You know,
so you don't think this has anything to do with Billy Bush trying to make a comeback?
I think it has a lot to do with him trying to make a comeback.
Absolutely. This is a strategic PR move for him to
write. He laid low for 14 months, and now he's
trying to... As soon as the tape resurrected recently in the news in the last week and week and a half, the publicist probably said, you're back in the news. This is a great time.
Trump did him the biggest favor in the world by saying this tape was manufactured.
He addressed that last night, too. He goes, it happened. I was on the
bus.
And
he also addressed the Matt Lauer issue slightly, from what I understand, where supposedly Matt tried to defend him not to get him fired.
Yes, he did do that. Well, anyway, moving on.
Birds of a feather.
Moving on. Okay, let's start with The Disaster Artist. Now, The Disaster Artist was written, stars, and directed by James Franco, who does a movie every 3 days.
Along with his brother, Dave Franco.
Right. Yeah. Dave Franco's in it, but James Franco did the writing and the directing. And, you know, it's interesting that I really like this movie, and it's interesting to me how James Franco could turn out so many movies a year, and it's not like, you know, some of them aren't too good, but the fact that he's doing a movie a week or a movie every other week and he could do something of this such high quality is amazing to me. This is based on a true story. It's sort of like Ed Wood to me. One of the worst movies ever made. What was the name of the movie?
The Room.
The Room. Right. Starring this guy.
Tommy
Wiseau. So this is the story of how Tommy Wiseau, who has this accent that nobody knows where it's from. He claims he's from New Orleans.
It sounds just dumb.
It doesn't really sound like a...
better than David.
It doesn't really sound like a...
He sounds like he's from Croatia or something.
Right. It doesn't really sound...
Somebody did some research and finally was born in Poland.
Yeah, they're saying Poland.
Yeah. Okay.
But we'll roll a little of the clip so people can hear what he sounds like.
Action! What line? What is lying?
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Okay.
Action.
What is lying?
He's one crazy guy.
So it's like where Ed Wood, that was in the 50s when he was doing, what was that movie, Jack? The horrible movie.
The one with...
Bela Lugosi and, you know.
Well, there's also a Nostradamus one that William Dafoe did, which uses the same template of telling how the movie got made.
Well, this is supposed to be a look at how this horrendous movie called The Room got made. This guy with this, Tommy Wiseau with this horrible accent apparently has unlimited access to money, which nobody understands. But there's a point when they want to rent. They go to Hollywood. Let's make our own movie, you know. And he goes into some rental equipment place, and he goes, "No, I'm going to buy all the equipment." Like nobody does that. He just buys all.
What are
the
you
equipment.
Shooting on, video or film? Both. I like to both because it's my vision.
And it's. I think it's funny. I think it's interesting. I'm just seeing. Franco, by the way, co-wrote the. Franco did not write it. I was wrong about that. He directed it and he stars in it. He did not have a hand.
Yeah, didn't Seth and Evan Goldberg? Didn't Seth and his buddy write that?
No, it was Scott
produced it.
Neustadter and Michael Weber wrote it with some other people.
It's very funny. It's not until we'll get to guess. It's not until the last part of the movie where and boy, stay till not just the end but the very end, because it has a Marvel Comics kind of a trick
after
thing
the
that
credits.
Happens at the end. But you don't realize how faithfully this thing has been recreated shot for shot until, I don't think I'm giving anything away. During the credits, they roll the two movies side by side, certain scenes, and it's incredible.
It's
but
pretty
yeah,
dead on.
Yeah, you're right. There's some unbelievable.
Exactly the way.
Here's the thing. Franco does make bad movies, but apparently he can pick up the phone and get almost anyone to show up. Because Seth Rogen does not have a huge, huge role in the movie, but he's in it.
Listen, there's a million cameos in this movie. It's like you watch this.
Kind of what I was setting you up for, but go ahead.
Charlize Theron crops right. up in the movie.
Who else?
And Josh Hutcherson is in the movie. I mean, there's just every time you look at something, Sharon Stone makes a brief appearance.
Yeah. As an agent. Very funny.
In the movie. I mean, Melanie Griffith is in the movie.
Yeah.
You just keep going. Bob Odenkirk is in the movie. Every once in a while.
Some people you can tell showed up for like a day of shooting, and then they had like a cameo, and they...
Tommy Wiseau is in the original. He's in the movie, too.
And there's a classic Judd Apatow scene where this guy goes up to him in a restaurant, and I guarantee you this has actually happened to Apatow. I would love to know in the original movie, The Room, whether there was anything like that, where there were some real filmmakers involved and showed up. But this is about the making of it, and it's very, very funny.
Adam Scott, Danny McBride, Kristen Bell, J.J. Abrams, Lizzie Kaplan. I mean, it just goes on and on. Every 3 minutes, you're looking around in this movie, and it's like,
A fake documentary thing at the top that throws a lot of famous people into it.
The thing about this film in particular is that everybody looks at this film as sort of the recreation of the worst movie ever made in the history of film, in The Room. But to me, I look at it differently. Yes, that's mostly what the premise is, but the movie to me is about dreamers. It sort of takes that La La Land look where it's two actors, right? Two dreamers trying to become actors and trying to reach stardom in Hollywood, which is almost impossible. So the similarities in those are very, very sort of on. And in this particular
case, it's always
good
to dream when you have millions of dollars.
Right.
By the way.
But the thing is, it's the hardships of trying, if you're a struggling actor, trying to make it in Hollywood. It's really about Dave Franco, who just can't seem to get, even though he's a good looking guy, is just, he just can't seem to access or get that
big
job.
But not Dave Franco, the character that he plays.
The character
is not a very
Dave
good
Franco.
Actor. I mean, you see him in acting class. And
there's a
the
lot of not good actors in Hollywood that are acting.
And that's accurate based on what we see of the real acting of the real guy.
Right, exactly.
I agree with Bill Brigoli. I mean, these dreams could never be realized. And they tell you, and it's not a spoiler, that we never know where Tommy Wiseau gets all this money from.
It's almost like, Neil, if we had a podcast and we wanted someone to listen to it, we could pay
but
for
you
it.
Look at the Good Will Hunting approach, which is exactly what they ended up doing. It says, look, if no one will hire us, and by the way, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck are stars today, that no one wanted to hire.
Right.
So once again, we focus in on, even if you are good, they're not good, obviously, in The Disaster Artist.
So they wrote their own movie.
But they decided to do their own movie.
But Matt Damon and Ben Affleck can be blamed for so many pals getting together in a basement, writing a screenplay, trying to make a movie, trying to come to Hollywood. That I just want to point out to anyone listening to this podcast, they are one not in a million or 10 million. They are one in a zillion, those two.
Well, right. Two things about that. First of all, there's a play. There was an off-Broadway play by Mindy Kaling before she got famous that actually looks at Matt and Ben. I think it's called Ben and Matt. I don't remember. I saw
she
it.
Played one of them, I think, in like a wig. Yeah, it's
and
funny.
It's about – it wasn't a great play, but it actually looks at them trying to do that. Secondly, Harvey Weinstein and Miramax green-lighted that particular project.
Through Kevin Smith.
Right,
yeah.
Despite – you know, unlike the Tommy Wiseau thing where, and I agree with you, Bill Brigoli, like 100%, it's one thing to dream, but it's one thing to dream and have like an endless deep pockets of millions and millions of dollars to like, all right, I'll make my own movie. I mean, who, like you said, one in a zillion. Who's got that? You know what
right.
I'm saying? So, you know.
That's why we're sitting in your living room doing this podcast
right.
instead of a major
Tommy Wiseau
production facility.
Didn't have those millions of dollars to make this piece of shit movie.
We wouldn't be talking about it today.
There would not be a movie called The Disaster Artist.
But did you know there was a movie called The Room that became a cult favorite? Because
yeah.
I thought I'd heard about all the cult midnight movies. And this
movie
one.
Brie Larson.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, so did I. Yeah.
That's
Room.
What I thought.
That's Room. This
that's
is The Room.
That's exactly what I thought. I'm like, yeah, right. Oh, wait a minute. That's a good movie. Wait, what are
you
they
know,
talking
one
about?
Thing Neil and I were talking about before we went on air was the fact that during the screening of the movie, when they're all the friends have been invited and they're all watching it, and then first of all, they're horrified by it. There's this part I just didn't buy where all of a sudden.
Yeah, that is a Hollywood.
Laughing.
Yeah.
Very Hollywood thing.
Where they what he's referring to is all of a sudden they start to laugh. All together, the 1,000 people,
right.
And suddenly
exactly.
stamp it a great, yeah,
that
stamp
chuckling.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
I know. So they took some license, probably.
You know, I thought James Franco probably gave one of the best performances. I mean, to kind of capture the essence of Tommy Wiseau, it is very unique. That Tommy Wiseau is a very unique person. I don't think there's anybody else like him.
By the way, the Saturday Night Live sketch that, based on what you just said, should be Tommy Wiseau in room where it's he and a little kid are stuck in this room, and like a remake of the Brie Larson thing. I'm going to get you out of here. The whole world out there.
I thought the casting was fantastic.
This is our chance to leave now.
I roll you in the carpet.
And it's a comedy, but you know, it's not a laugh out loud comedy, but I do think that the tone is just perfect.
There's a couple of laugh out loud moments, and if I tell them now, it'll screw it up for you in the show.
Roll you in the carpet. That's very funny.
Okay, calm down. Let's move
on. I like that. Well, I always appreciate when you're funny. All right. So anyway, so Bill Bregoli did not really, you didn't love the film.
I didn't totally love it. It was fun. It was a nice diversion.
Mm-hmm. I highly recommend it.
I really enjoyed it. I thought, again, Franco was great. I thought the cast was great. I thought the tone of the whole film was fantastic. The cameos did it, but that Judd Apatow scene is
worth the whole thing. Yeah, I liked it, but I'm, you know, my daughter's a huge fan of Dave Franco, and my wife and daughter watched it. My daughter fell asleep, and my wife said, it's a bad movie about a bad movie.
Yeah, but we're all movie people.
So right, so that's the problem with us recommending
it. But it is Ed Wood, isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
structurally.
Yeah, it is.
I mean,
yeah.
Ed Wood was a really out there crazy character, the guy himself. This guy's an out there crazy character.
Right.
He believes passionately but I'll tell you in his vision of this terrible movie.
Maybe so you'll agree. At the last, when I see the very end, I was thinking, boy, this would almost make a better documentary. Like, I would love to see a documentary about
it. I liked it the way it was.
It's cool, but like, let's.
And when you get to the set of the movie, when they're actually filming this thing, and the DP and all these other people are like, "What? Just film it." And he can't do his like 95 takes to do one. Because he's a terrible actor, he can't do his. I mean, it's kind of funny. I liked
it. It's great.
All right, moving on. So my disc for I, Tonya was not working, so I did not see it.
Somebody kneecapped it. Somebody hit it.
But fortunately, the three people here did, so which is great. I can ask you about it. So who would like to take the lead on
Jack, tell us about
I, Tonya.
You know, I, Tonya is a reinterpretation for the most part of the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan debacle that occurred, was it the late 90s?
Early 90s. Yeah.
Everybody heard the news, and so this one sort of takes like a genuine, truthful look from the lens of Tonya Harding of how that bashing of the knee kind of went down. What you're expecting is a bit of a Lifetime biopic here. And what I got was something completely the opposite. It's a stylish film directed by a very stylish director, extremely well cast. I think everybody from Allison Janney to Margot Robbie.
Margot Robbie plays
Tonya Harding.
Right, and Allison Janney's the mom.
Allison Janney's the mom. And then you had Sebastian Stan from Captain America was there.
Mustache.
And he plays the husband.
He's good.
And Nancy Kerrigan, I understand, very minor part.
Very minor role.
Very
because
minor,
it's really
yeah.
not about her. It's about, you know, sort of her perspective and where she was living in order to get to that moment. I know that, I think it was you, Bill, that mentioned that this was Goodfellas on Ice.
Yeah, I called it Goodfellas on Ice. That was
dark comedy.
Yeah,
dark
with a lot of narration and a lot of that kind of music that infuses like
stuff.
A Scorsese
you
thing.
Mentioned,
and a lot of breaking the fourth wall.
TV show right. The Office, they're looking right in the camera.
Yeah, at one point, Allison Janney comes on, who's been bitching through the whole movie at her daughter, and bitches at the camera. Well, I guess my story's over. Nobody's talking about me anymore. And
right.
then she
so
picks up her storyline.
Faux documentary, mockumentary style with it. They used all the clever tricks to make this film very fun, very memorable as well. But I think that the highest and the best attribute for this film is the performances. I would give Margot Robbie definitely best actress nomination for this.
Is she not
Allison
too
Janney
old?
Gets
she,
one. I think she's locked for supporting actress as well.
How old was Nancy Kerrigan when this thing happened? Like, are they very
19?
Yeah,
right.
19.
So Margot Robbie's not too old to play.
Well, Margot Robbie's
role?
A little older. I
yeah.
think she's like in her mid 20s, and that's one of the issues when she comes back. She gets a break because the Winter Olympics aren't going to be every 4 years for one. Some reason there's going to be another one in 2 years. So that's one of the other reasons she gets to make sort of a comeback. No, she pulls off the aging. I'll tell you, the hardest thing is she plays older later because she's being interviewed like documentary style later.
Like many years
but that
later.
That she pulls off well too. I think. Listen, I think there's every stylistic trick in the book, as you were referring to, Jack. There's a point in this movie where the camera literally gets out of the house, jumps in the back of a car, and drives away,
right. yeah,
and it's like
great.
Breathtaking. It's so
yes.
cool.
Would you say it was? Would you categorize it? comedy? Would you call
it
absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. It's laugh out loud, dark comedy.
So basically you would send somebody to this movie like saying like, you want to, I mean, not a comedy like, wow, you know,
it's full of
Porky's, right, but I mean, it's like, yeah, you want to let, you'd send somebody here to like say it's a comedy.
The language
laugh.
Is incredibly blue, but funny as hell.
When, oh yeah, my God.
When Allison Janney says to her, you skated like a bull dyke. I'm ashamed for you.
Yeah.
I couldn't help.
And you don't marry dumb, you fuck dumb. I mean, yeah, that's the, her mother actually told her that.
Yeah. What a great performance by Allison Janney in that film. I mean, one of the best supporting actor sort of moments that you see of 2017 there.
In kind of the same role as Laurie Metcalf has,
yes,
in Lady Bird.
In Lady Bird.
And they're probably
going to
compete against, yeah, one another. And that's very unusual that the roles are so similar.
Does the movie, both this movie, I, Tonya, well, let's start with I, Tonya. Do you think, other than the Allison Janney nomination, which you think, and mm-hmm, you were saying she's going to compete with...
and I think it could be
Laurie
a screenplay nod. It's really clever.
Yeah, yeah. Metcalf.
Absolutely.
Is it
going to
get a Best
screenplay.
Picture nomination?
I think so. I think if you look
well,
at
in a year
eight.
Of in a year of 10, sure.
Yeah.
Jill?
Yeah.
You think it's
going to
get a Best Picture nomination?
Well, yeah.
Okay. Now,
there's
what about
really
the,
not that many flaws with it.
What about The Disaster Artist? Do you think that's going to get any Academy Award nominations?
I think it might. The BFCA, which, you know, picks Best Action, Best Comedy, or, you know, something like that.
We nominated last night. You didn't call me.
Yeah.
I was waiting for you to call me.
All right. Get off your high horse. We'll go through
that. When are they going to announce that, by the way? When are they going to announce their nominations?
Yeah, next week?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A couple of days.
Well, I don't know. You don't think Disaster Artist will get anything?
No. I think there are other much better films. I mean, we're talking about Mudbound.
If you look at GoldDerby.com, and I'll give them a plug, they have a lot of our colleagues on there that make predictions. And you go to critics, the experts' picks. And it seems to be the same, you know, within the same pool of 12 to 14 movies to be culled from those 10 movies that are going to get the Oscar nominations. And
if they do 10, they haven't done 10
every.
And
if they have 7 picks... you know, out of the 5 that are going to get nominated for actor, actress, director, supporting actor, and supporting actor, it seems to be the same pool. I mean, it seems to be like, you know, The Post, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks on the show, the Steven Spielberg film is going to get nominated for Best Picture,
not that
as will
it.
Shape of Water, as will Call Me By Your Name, as will Dunkirk, as will Darkest Hour. You know, it seems the Florida Project seems to be getting, we'll talk about that when that opens up. You know,
well,
it seems to
yeah.
be the same pool of movies that will be, you know.
I will say in Disaster Artist's favor that it came on a lot stronger in the last 2 weeks than anybody ever thought it was going to, because everyone knew the premise, but they hadn't seen it yet. And then it opened somewhere. Was it at Toronto? I'm not sure. It's all of a sudden people are like, whoa, this is really good. I still agree with you. I don't think it's going to win an Oscar
nomination.
I have
a question. Slumdog Millionaire, mm-hmm. which won the Academy Award for Best Picture a number of years back, literally came out of nowhere. I mean, that movie almost didn't even get a full, like, wide release in America. I mean, it just kind of like, it went from nothing.
A Weinstein film, too.
Right.
No,
to,
it was for Fox Searchlight.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, that's right.
Well,
oh.
anyway, but my question is, okay, this is December. At what, in December, early December of the year that movie wound up winning Best Picture, and I remember it was like it went from zero to 80 in like 2 seconds. At early December, the year that was nominated, at this point in that year, was it even in the conversation?
Yeah, it was starting. Yeah.
I think there's two things that happened that year. One, you had the critics' take on that film. And then once the audience saw it, there was a whole other consideration because they loved the film so much that the critics were influenced by the audience reaction. So that then catapulted the film to critical and commercial success. It's one of the few films that actually did well on both sides, winning Best Picture.
Do you think that it was in, Bill, that it was in the conversation in early December of like, oh, this is going to be a Best Picture nominee, you know?
I forget when I saw it. I do remember when I saw it, the print broke. How long ago there was a print.
Because I'm trying to think if there's a movie out there that's not... on
the
that
greatest
gold
showman.
Or is there anything we haven't seen?
That's going to come
what
out of
nowhere. The Showman with Hugh Jackman that has not
The
been
Showman
seen.
With Hugh Jackman could be a huge surprise, although I hear it's kind of a clunker.
Plummer thing.
And then there's
All the Money in the World.
Nobody's seen that either.
Well, they're not done. They just finished it.
Well, I mean, saw there's a trailer running on TV.
So it's being shown.
How much money will you give for your grandson? And he goes, nothing.
It's being shown this week.
Yeah. What? They used a different, but that was the Kevin
Spacey. But Christopher Plummer's in this one, you know?
Yeah, yeah, no, the trailer's out.
Can one see the original trailer with Kevin Spacey?
Yeah. They finally, no, they took it out.
You can't dig around. It's gone now. You can't dig around and find it.
You know, one of our colleague pals says that they'd be crazy that Ridley Scott should absolutely show the other performance on the DVD. They should do the deleted scenes with.
We should tell people what we're talking about here anyway.
So Kevin Spacey was accused of sexual harassment by Anthony Rapp, who was an actor on Broadway, mostly known for a show called Rent. And there was talk that Anthony Rapp had accused him of Kevin Spacey sexually molesting him when he was 14 years old during a Broadway play.
Yeah.
As soon as that happened, more people came out and they suspended production of House of Cards, and literally his whole career imploded.
Right. So what they did with this movie.
So what they did with this movie is that Ridley Scott, by the way, unprecedented. I had never heard of anybody doing this. They removed him completely from any scenes that were already produced.
Finish this, and then
produced.
I will tell you when they have done this.
And
before.
Then they decided that they were going to replace him with Christopher Plummer. Now everybody thought, how possibly are you going to be able to do this in such a short amount of time?
Well, it is a short role.
I can do this.
It is a short. It is a short role.
It's the same amount of time that Spacey spent on the picture.
Well, look at that. So, but because
Christopher Plummer was who they wanted in the first place. Yeah, by the way,
is that true?
Yeah. And the studio wanted a name.
Well, you can see the terrible makeup job they did on Kevin Spacey to do that.
I
gotta
see that show. Well, here's where they've done that before, not because of sexual harassment charges where they had to replace somebody, but they shot. And this is available. You can go on YouTube. You can go on the bonus DVD disc on Back to the Future.
Oh, well, everybody
Andrew
knows that
McCarthy
story.
And you could see the same. I mean, how many times have
not
we
Andrew
all
McCarthy,
seen Back to the Future?
Eric Stoltz.
I was just
I'm
gonna
so
say.
Sorry. Eric Stoltz.
Eric Stoltz.
Same guy.
No.
No, it was Eric Stoltz, who did not have the humor and charisma and fun into the character that Zemeckis wanted. But we all know that movie Up and Down, and you see these scenes of, and actually they're in the actual movie. Michael J. Fox talks about this, and Robert Zemeckis talks about this. There are scenes where you're not you see the back of it. It's Eric Stoltz on the skateboard and stuff. But you can look at the scenes back to back, sort of like The Disaster Artist when they show you the room,
right?
And then
right.
the redoing of the room.
But how much of that film was already shot? With
A couple
Eric
of weeks.
Stoltz?
They were a couple of they were like two or three weeks in and had
because
the
whole skateboarding
from what I understand
scene,
with Kevin Spacey, that movie was basically almost done.
Oh yeah, well Kevin Spacey, it was locked. There was
yeah,
locked.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
it was locked.
The whole skateboarding scene in Back to the Future when he's in 1955. And he's trying to run away from Biff. The Biff. Biff
yeah.
Tannen, right. And he's going through the whole town, which is really the universal backlot in California. Right. That whole thing was shot with Eric Stoltz. And there's the scene in the I believe the one when
the
he's
diner.
In the diner when he sees the coffee shop when he sees his dad. You know, and it's really kind of weird to watch it, you know what I mean? Because you know the movie so well. And
but that's how important, you know, having
but
a
Zemeckis was
actor,
right.
Yeah.
I mean if you look at Michael J. Fox's reaction to seeing his dad, these comic takes, you know, and you see Eric Stoltz, it just isn't really that funny, you know. So
but now it's
and Michael J. Fox was the original guy in Pulp Fiction that takes the epidural needle and puts it into
He's the original. Quentin Tarantino wanted. The part that Quentin Tarantino winds up playing in Pulp Fiction, which is when Travolta
Mr. Wolf.
And
shows up with Mr. And, Wolf with
William Wolf,
Harvey
right?
Keitel.
But the guy in the house that they want to clean the house before the wife gets home to doing her shift or whatever she was working the night shift or whatever, and he's like making Quentin Tarantino says, you know, this is great coffee. I don't want to hear you talking about my fucking coffee. I just want you to clean this mess up. My wife's coming home and blah blah blah. That was originally, but Michael J. Fox was, I think, in Australia making a movie. He wasn't available. But they also, I think, originally wanted Michael J. Fox to do before they cast Eric Stoltz in Back to the Future, but he was committed to family ties. And finally, when they redid it, and Spielberg, by the way, was instrumental since he's the producer of Back to the Future, and I'm going to move off this trivia shit.
By the way,
getting Zemeckis, who wasn't as well-known at the time,
is,
to do
it. What we need to find out, like, when the DVD comes out, is who did the better performance. Because I like Plummer, but Kevin Spacey is one hell of an actor.
All right, so Bill McCuddy and I watched this. I watched it, and then I told Bill McCuddy to watch it yesterday, and thank you, Bill, for watching it. Amazon Prime is promoting, really spending a lot of money to promote this new big budgeted television series called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Now, Bill and I have a fondness for stand-up comedy. Bill does stand-up comedy. I did it many, many years ago, but I hang out in comedy places. And this is about the
I didn't know that, Neil.
Yeah, well.
You were a stand-up comic for how many years?
It was like a year. But anyway, it wasn't
the audience fun. Spoke.
Anyway, that's another story.
Another topic, okay.
But this takes place in 1958. And it's really like the sexist 1950s. Women are housewives. You know, she has kids. And she wants to do this totally, you know, out there thing, which is,
Well, she doesn't at first.
Right. But she sort of finds her way into becoming a stand-up comedy at the Gaslight Cafe downtown in the Village in Manhattan. Her husband, and I'm not... Her husband works in, it looks like an ad agency or something
or
like
insurance,
that.
Insurance, I think. You
know, he's got a big office, like, in, you know, on Park Avenue.
Like Mad Men, like Don Draper's corner
right.
office.
And they got kids and they live in this fancy apartment and they're Jewish, which is a little too stereotyped in the show. But nonetheless, he wants to be a comic and he goes after his day job and she helps him and she bakes brisket to give to the club owners so she gets a better time slot in the club. They're giving him like 2 a.m. and
like
she gets
bribing the guys, right?
Yeah, right. And she gets
this actually sounds worse than it is.
He gets these better time slots due to her cooking and she comes down to support him. But he's not a good comic. He's stealing Bob Newhart routines. Did you know, by the way, when he first performed that Abe Lincoln routine, that was a Bob Newhart?
I thought
routine?
It was a little too polished for a guy who I didn't know it was Newhart.
It was Newhart.
Yeah.
So he's stealing other people's material.
But is this like Big Sick where it revolves around a stand up comic?
No, he
a little bit. You know the okay.
He
go
leaves
ahead.
Her for his secretary. She's left as a single mom with her two kids,
boy and a girl.
And she goes down to the Gaslight looking for her husband on the night that he leaves her, and
she's a little drunk.
It's a little contrived. You know, she leaves.
It's a lot contrived, but that's okay.
She goes on stage and she starts ranting to the audience about how her life is all messed up.
Is it a TV show?
Yeah.
How many episodes?
Eight episodes, and it's on Amazon Prime. And I think it's kind of loosely based like on Joan Rivers or something.
It's definitely loosely based on a bunch of different women comics
like
early
Fields
in the 50s. And Phyllis Diller, who always talked about her husband, Fang.
Yeah.
And,
but what's the point of the show, though?
It's... the point is it's...
it's like a Mad Men
women breaking
women
into
in stand-up
comedy.
So it's
but
women
it's tonality
into,
very, yeah. very close to a movie Man. Called My Favorite Year. Did you ever see that with Mark Lynn Baker
and
Peter O'Toole? The families feel very similar. Although these families are a little wealthier. They live on two different... And the supporting cast is amazing. Tony Shalhoub is one of the dads.
Kevin Pollak. I saw him in the band's visit on Broadway. Was that
Kevin Pollak is the other dad. It's really, really, really well done. And what I will say, while I don't recommend it for everyone, is that normally in these sorts of things, the stand-up is dreadful and the story around it is pretty good. In this case, I think the story around it is a little cliched, but the stand-up is pretty remarkable. And she gets on stage and starts talking about her life. That is a contrivance that gets her up there. The second time she does it, the little guy woman that runs the club, who used to be on I don't know the actress's name, but she used to be on Mad TV. She was Mrs. Swan. You look like a man. So she bolts up to the stage, pushes a beat poet out of the way, just as it's like a masterful thing.
Well, that was
just
very
as our
funny.
Star
the
Rachel
beat poet, the week, the first
takes
episode
the
is just doing the name of a town. That's her whole poem. And in the second episode, she's got the name of another town.
Yeah.
Throws
Neil, so who is this show for?
Apparently just Neil and I.
I don't know. It's a very good question, Jack. You know, Lenny Bruce is a character in the show, which is crazy. I mean, she's busted for obscenity, you know, and she runs into Lenny Bruce in like a jail cell.
So is this like the 70s?
No, it's the 50s.
No, it's the 50s.
It's late
like,
film.
It's just
okay,
like...
Okay.
And it's just like Mad Men goes to a comedy club.
She asks Lenny Bruce, you know, if he, you know, it's a hard business. What do you love what you do, you know? I think if you're a comedy aficionado, I love the time.
It sounds to me like it's very esoteric.
I love the time period, okay? So, you know, we talked about Wonder Wheel the other week. You know, yes, it's a flawed movie, but I thought it was beautifully shot and it really captured the early 50s.
The cinematography was excellent. It's probably one of his best.
The color in that movie is the color.
Yeah, Kate Winslet was fantastic as well.
So this really captures, I mean, it's, the village in the late 1950s. And then you have the whole dichotomy where she lives uptown. And it's, you know, the husband leaves her and the father immediately says to her, you know, like, what did you do wrong? It's your fault. I don't, well, he won. I don't, what did
put you on your prettiest dress and paint your face and go get your husband back.
What are you going to do with two kids without a husband? What are you, it's like, it's
Dustin Hoffman will love it.
it's such a, it just like Mad Men showed you, it's not as good as Mad Men, two episodes in anyway, but just the way that showed you the attitudes in the 50s that were not just sexist, but just the whole mindset. There's a scene in Mad Men when they go on a picnic and they leave everything. Like, nobody thinks to clean up after themselves. They leave all the litter on the grass and
this
the park.
This is much more lighthearted than Mad Men. That's why I brought up my favorite year.
Comic.
And the tonality is much more heartwarming-y kind of a thing. And
as a Jew, it's a little too stereo. Oy, Gewalt, let's get the.
It's a little too on the schnoz.
The stuffed dharma for Yom Kippur and for breakfast. I mean, it's just a little over the top. It's like stereotypes of Jews. You know what
God,
I mean?
Yeah.
It's a little too over the top. But I like it. I think if you like the period, the time period, and look at how far women's rights have come, mm-hmm, you know, because mm-hmm. It's like
I will say this: it's a magnificent expenditure of money if it's a failure, because they closed down streets on Park Avenue to do like cabs arriving and stuff. They took over part of 7th Avenue for a garment district scene that really is just a walk by scene.
They
so
CGI'd
they
out
spent
the Panhandle
a lot of money
life building
right.
on Park Avenue. There's a bunch of Martin Scorsese tracking shots where they follow this guy who goes into the garment center to see his dad.
Yeah, that's what I just was referring to.
And that goes on for like 5 minutes.
Yeah,
it's
yeah, yeah.
A lot of money. All right, anyway, I kind of recommend it. We'll see where
I
it goes.
I kind of do too.
All right.
doesn't sound very...
So Alex,
it's worth trying.
Bill Bregoli was privy to seeing the entire second season of The Crown.
My wife loves the show.
My wife
never
loves
seen
the show.
Never seen it.
Right.
It's
how
not
does it compare to the first you're about to ask me? The events in her life aren't quite as tumultuous as they are in the first one. In the first one, she falls in love, her father dies, she becomes queen. Nothing as big as that happens, but it's still extremely interesting. This follows her from around 1950, when Prince Edward, at the beginning, is sent off. It's like, get out of here, please, to the Southern Hemisphere to tour the colonies like Australia and Antarctica. They want to get him out of the way, and they do, and he comes back kind of ticked off. And in the middle, there's a one-off sort of episode where the queen gets advice from a commoner about her speeches, and she actually takes the advice, and that's a pretty interesting episode. Then they move
That's like Darkest Hour when Winston Churchill gets on the...
On the bus, yeah.
Or the subway.
Well, in this, though, the commoner is invited to the castle, and... He thinks he's meeting with one of her flunkies, and then she shows up in the room, and she's pretty snooty about it, but she ends up taking his suggestions, one of which was to televise her Christmas message. It was the first time she had ever done that.
But the production values...
Values are great.
There's a scene... I haven't really watched the show, but when my wife and daughter are watching it, I peek in occasionally. There was an episode in the first... Also talking about money spent here.
Yeah.
Where the guy takes a flying lesson.
Oh, well, he flies a lot in this.
And there's these aerial shots of, like, the countryside in antique planes.
And in this one, he's
And I'm
flying
going, man, this money was spent on this thing, you know?
Note to Neil's family, he spies on you.
If you haven't seen The Crown Season 1, can somebody who's never seen the show...
You can still pick it up.
Can you just jump into Season 2 and kind of get...
Yeah,
without
sure.
But Jack, why would you want to, since it's on Netflix?
Because it's like, just landed. So, you know, to get to see season two, do I have to go through the whole first season?
This,
I might be just, you know.
This takes you up to the Profumo scandal, which is the end of the thing.
So if you were
can you see
on
it all? Can I mean,
yeah,
you saw it all, but
yeah,
can everybody see it all?
On December 8th, it goes wide or whatever they call it.
It goes up on Netflix, all the episodes.
Yeah, and there's also a very interesting episode where she meets Jackie and Jack Kennedy. And
oh,
it's
really?
The darkest side of Camelot I have ever seen.
Does Jack fuck her?
No, Jack beats up Jackie.
What?
Yeah, Jack beats up Jackie.
Ouch.
Yeah,
really?
Now, is
nasty.
This based on some...
Yeah, it's based...
John F. Kennedy beats up Jackie
yeah,
Kennedy?
Yeah, remember, this was written and directed in England.
Wow.
They
is that, did that happen?
Revisionist history?
You should
do
see...
Do you believe that happened?
Does she pull the trigger in this version?
Jackie tells
in
the queen,
Dallas?
Jackie tells the queen... Has to apologize to the queen at one point. And
for
tells
a black
her the
eye?
Reason, no, for... dissing the Queen after the two of them met and got along fine and got to meet her corgis. She hears later that Jackie had said some nasty things about the Queen and particularly the Windsor Castle.
So how many...
And then afterwards, Jackie says to her, well, they've been drugging us up.
What?
Yeah. You got to see it. Man. I think it's around the seventh
episode. What
episode
is this?
I think it's seven.
I'm just jumping right into it.
Yeah. Wait, do you have to watch the first season?
Yeah, forget
have
all. To watch, I'm just going to watch episode seven.
You have to watch the first six episodes of the season two.
Use McCuddy's phrase. Yeah, fuck the rest of the show. I'm not into that. I'm just going to watch this thing.
That's a new term for you?
Okay. Yeah. Well, you used the word before.
Check it out. It's there's also Princess Margaret falling in love with the Earl Snowden, the photographer, played by Matthew Good. He's terrific in it.
So if you gave, I give apples, but let's do stars. If you give the first, how many stars out of four would you give the first season?
First season you'd probably give a four.
How many jewels do you give the crown?
Three and a half is still good.
Yeah, it's very good. And I got to tell you, I watched it at 2-3 in the morning during one of my many jobs.
Your overnight shift.
Yeah, my overnight shift. And
in full sleep. Like.
Bill, what is it about the crown that people like
Coco
so much?
Last night, but what's that?
What is it about the crown?
Coco? I'm sorry, you saw Coco last night?
Yeah, I saw Coco on a screener and fell asleep watching that.
Did you like Coco before you fell asleep?
It was okay. It was all right. But it was
does it compare to, is it a Monster Zinc or?
Making a lot of dough. Making a lot of dough.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, what'd you
think? Oh, please, Jack.
It's Latin American. He's not going to watch it, Jack.
That's fine. Talk about Jack Rico.
He's too Jewish.
Well, now tell.
Okay. Mexican Jews, right?
Okay. Before you did this, how far deep did you go into it before you fell asleep, Bill Brigoli?
Maybe halfway.
Okay. Tell us about Coco.
You saw You didn't see Coco.
Coco is going to be the winner at the Oscars for Best Animated Feature.
I would agree with that.
All right. It's only competition.
And having not even seen it, I would agree.
Only
with that.
The competition. Its only competition is the breadwinner. But besides that, it's the first movie in a long time for Pixar where they've refound their footing, because I feel like they've been stumbling a lot. And this is
Brave. Really, is not in the same league.
No, not at
Nemo
all.
Or Toy Story.
This is a movie
or...
that will make you cry. It's about a Mexican family, but it's really a movie about tradition and remembering people who have passed away in our family, and still having and keeping those memories still alive and fresh.
Does Trump build an animated wall?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Coco not getting in.
Not at all.
Keeping
but
you
I,
down there.
It leaves the politics to the side. And I think what it does extremely quite well is it blends together sort of these rich family traditions that anybody can have. But at the same time, it once again tugs at the heart so incredibly well that by the end of the film, it doesn't matter if you're a tough guy or not, you will be crying.
So having seen, and I'm sure you, like we all have seen like pretty much all the Pixar films, mm-hmm. would you consider this in the same league as, let's say, I'll name some brilliant, WALL-E.
I knew he was going to go to WALL-E.
This goes into the pantheon of some of the best Disney and Pixar films ever made. They did this well. They took 6 years to research the film. Initially, they wanted to copyright Day of the Dead, Día de los Muertos, and that set off a horrible, social media blitz where they had to completely stop doing that.
That's the scene at the beginning of that Bond film, right?
Yeah,
the two Bond films ago, or one Bond.
You talking about the Live and Let Die scene?
No, dude. Come to our century. This is the Spectre. Remember, it opens in Mexico City where everybody's wearing...
Masks,
so the whole movie is kind of based around that festival,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and the movie is really about a kid that feels that he needs to be a musician. It's his calling. But his family doesn't want him to be a musician because his father earlier on had left and abandoned the family to become a musician. So they didn't want him to follow in the same footsteps. So there's this clash from the very beginning, and the kid then transports himself to the Day of the Dead. He's the only living being in this dead world.
And he wants to get back.
I had to guess. Try and save
himself. You would say this is in the same league as the best Pixar movies.
The best Pixar's
ever
made.
Yeah, but Jack.
Absolutely.
Guys.
I know.
Nobody's talking about it.
Well, talk about
Nobody's talking about it. It's making more money than any of the other movies, that, right? It was number one last weekend.
It was number one. It did about 80 million sort of dollars.
Talk about the discrimination it's getting. If it's one of the best Pixar's, no one's talking about it.
You know, I don't think it's a discrimination at all. If anything, it has 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, so it's critically acclaimed by everybody. I think that the big problem as a Latino film critic for me is...
Right, you would be the guy to answer this question.
Of course.
I wrote an article called
The Latino Significance of This Film, and I think one of the big key topics, pop culturally speaking, is that this is one of the few films where the whole ensemble is Latino, and not only that, they're brown skin as opposed to white skin Hispanics. And I think that brown skin allows the rest of America to sort of normalize that watching brown skin or black skin or dark skin on screen is okay, and they could be critically acclaimed the way Lin-Manuel Miranda's on Broadway, Hamilton, and In the Heights won these best musicals. So I think that this is a great trend in animation for kids, especially Latino kids, that don't have sort of that self-confidence to head into the office.
Trump's middle America is not going to this movie.
Right, so this is sort of
saying... I'm sorry. They're just not.
You said it's making a ton of money.
But listen...
It's making some money.
Okay, so maybe...
Hispanic money.
It's tough to say because... There were women, white women, blonde, blue-eyed, that were right sitting next to me that were tearing right next to me as they were watching Coco. So I think it's
Had
a film
eaten
for
onions?
Everybody.
Was there any
Did you love it, Bill,
could've...
before you fell asleep? Because you were watching it at 3 in the morning?
I liked the animation. The story wasn't really getting me, but the
Let me ask you something. Did you feel that you connected in any way with the family story?
No, not my family.
Oh, okay, so maybe it's subjective.
Was, please, be a musician.
Okay. So it's different.
So you don't have to go to Vietnam. Do something.
But the movie for the second straight week is number one at the box office,
good.
Beating the Justice League. So I think it's doing quite well. I think it's critically acclaimed and it's commercially successful. So
and
I think
if you're going to take your kids to a movie about death.
This is a great way of looking
the movie.
At death. Yeah,
yeah.
This
one of the Hollywood Reporter, one of the Variety said, one of their stories was why Coco will have much longer legs than Justice League. And it was taking this past weekend and saying, right. It's just the beginning. This thing
couple
could
of
run
quick
for a while.
Things. Curb Your Enthusiasm wrapped up its season.
I haven't been able to
finale.
See the whole thing. Is it as good as the previous season?
Well, did you like the finale?
Well, here's my thoughts on Curb Your Enthusiasm. As I've discussed on this podcast in the past, I thought the first four episodes, I think there were 10 episodes, right, Bill?
Ten.
Well, the first four were not so good. But then up until the finale, the last three or four of them were brilliant.
So those are the ones I'm going to watch.
They were brilliant. They were on the same level as early Curb. And the finale got a little too – I mean, it was different. It was with Lin-Manuel Miranda, and they were doing a musical version just the way they did in a previous season. They did the producers, and they had a big budget thing on stage with Larry David and David Schwimmer playing, you know, Bialystok and Bloom. They have a fictitious musical called Fatwa. And Lin-Manuel Miranda's doing Hamilton-esque type numbers with his rap lyrics
right.
to Fatwa. They've got big
that.
Broadway dancers on stage, and they, you know. So, you know, I thought it overreached a little, but I thought it was interesting. I don't think it was like wow. I mean, I thought the penultimate episode the week before and the two or three before that were great. I thought this was okay. What we
they renewed.
If they had rolled him in a carpet and taken him out, yeah. It would have been much better. I haven't seen the finale.
Oh.
I've seen only the couple of episodes that you told
it
me to
for another season.
Well, it's up to Larry David whether or not he
well,
wants to
supposedly
do it.
Supposedly,
no, they renew it every
HBO
year.
Said,
they tell
he
him
can
he can
do whatever
it. It
he
took
wants.
Him 9 years to bring it back.
Before I leave the Curb conversation, Larry said if he does another. Larry David said if he does another season, he's not going to wait another 6 years like he did last
okay.
time. I have a feeling he will. But they left it at the end of the show where if it is the last season, which I doubt it will be, you could end the series on that particular
So note. You were satisfied with the ending?
Yeah, it wasn't like...
Better than the Seinfeld finale.
Oh, I just watched that again the other day.
Yeah, it was on for some reason.
It was on Channel 11 here in New York or something, and I was watching it, and I'm like, yeah, that is...
You have a lot of free time
TV?
Now, don't you?
You're still watching TV?
Well, I flip around. I watch a lot of stuff. All right, and last but not least, Alec Baldwin. Alec Baldwin is getting his podcast, since we do a podcast... Alec Baldwin
I love
is getting
this podcast.
Is getting what's
yeah, it's really good.
It's called
Here's the Thing.
Here's the Thing.
Right, and that's
really just
it's
an excuse for him to sit around.
Now it's going to be a network television show.
Here,
people
yeah,
forget
so,
that he had an MSNBC
ABC.
Television show based on the same podcast.
Bill de Blasio
that got,
was his first guest.
Yeah,
and,
that was not. He did a great hour with Deborah Winger. He's. Let me tell you something. He's the right man in the right place, not for ABC, but to take over Charlie Rose's job.
Really?
That's what I think. That's what I think. He's smart to many audiences. Lots of people don't like him. I understand
that. Are they talking
about
him to do that?
No, but I'm saying this would
Christiana
be an interesting... Christiana
Amanpour replaced them. Charlie Rose on PBS.
For the time being.
For the short interim.
Yeah.
Huh.
There's no move ahead on CBS.
Say again?
There's no... From what I hear and my ear to the ground, they're not exactly killing themselves to replace him on CBS.
They've been begging Oprah to come in and fill in for
a
while.
She said there's no way she's doing it. Why would she go wake up?
Not one of her favorite things.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. So, yeah, Alec Baldwin's podcast is really good, but he tried to make a television series on MSNBC, which sounds exactly like this. And so I wish him well.
Is this a primetime slot?
No. It's
so here are the details on it. So what the podcast is from WNYC. He basically interviews all these celebrities. But the great thing about it and the appeal about the podcast, it's a celebrity talking to a celebrity. So there's so much insider dialogue that really makes it enlightening and interesting to the listener. So I think they want to sort of adapt sort of that level of conversation onto the television screen. They were supposed to start producing the first episode next week. But unfortunately, because the contract negotiations are still being discussed, and I'm sure he's asking for a lot, and maybe, you know, changes in producers and things like that, that they don't know exactly when this will air. Because they already have Nightline, and they have so many things at night with Jimmy Kimmel and everything
else.
Yeah,
it's a late night thing. It would be after Kimmel or instead of Nightline.
I think on the weekend it would work well.
Hey, well, I don't know. I mean, and about your contract negotiation, I think this was all, I was told this was all part of the contract and the reason he signed for Match Game, that this was the kicker in it, that he
produces Match Game.
Right. But I mean, he got this as part of that deal. So I think that deal is done. I just don't know when they're.
With ABC, Kelly and Ripa.
Yeah, I can't believe she's not gone yet. Or he's not gone.
Every week.
We watch a lot of bad stuff, so you don't have
that's
to.
That's what we do. That's true. And I don't know.
Were you falling asleep here like Bergoli in the middle of Coco?
No.
All right. Bill. So what are we doing next week?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Next week.
Star Wars.
Oh, that thing.
Star Wars.
Nothing but Star Wars.
That's right. We're doing Star Wars. We've got Grace Randolph from Beyond the Trailers YouTube show. To talk about Star Wars.
Much better retake.
And, you know, when we're
Star Wars.
We're going to talk about
it. We're going to go see it.
We're going to see Star Wars.
What are we expecting from this Star Wars? Do we think, for me, I think it's the one that's going to break the $200 million barrier. It's the return of Luke Skywalker.
I have a feeling they're going to use lightsabers in it. It's just a guess. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm going to go out.
I think it's going to be one of their best.
I think there might not be any many Jews in it.
Just
so you know, Neil, don't go expecting.
I don't know. I mean, they could make the worst movie ever.
No Jedi warriors,
which Lucas kind of did with those. One of those, the Jar Jar Binks one was not
the Force Awakens.
It'll still make a ton of money.
Wasn't it that it was going to be nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars? A lot of awards.
Well, the Broadcast Film Critics Association,
gave it
halted its revised its voting schedule in order to see that film. And consider it. It was thought that it might make into the top 10.
What was the
but
last one? The last one, the one last year. They have one a year now.
Rogue.
That was a spinoff.
Yeah, it was an independent in between The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi. Yeah. So they're doing these spinoffs, and that was a multicultural, diverse, inclusive sort of Star Wars that worked well.
Yeah. So this picks up where the one from two or three installments ago.
Yeah, it's a continuation of The Force Awakens.
Right, where she ran into Mark Hamill on the
Irish
Island. So we're going to see Carrie Fisher, because that was wrapped and done, right?
Yes.
So there's a lot of Carrie Fisher in this,
right.
Which is going to be kind of sad.
That all next week.
And we should tell people, because the people who listen to this podcast know that, we get screeners or we get to see.
They ain't giving us a screener of this.
We get to watch it at a bunch of different times. This is one screening.
One showing.
Next
no
Monday.
Guests. Come alone.
No guests.
Alone at home.
Be there or forget about it.
Right.
Or wait online.
Don't come at the last minute, Neil Rosen. It says right on the invitation.
That's a Jeffrey Lyons thing.
No, you're pretty good at that now, too.
All right. Well, anyway, I will get there early.
Roman J. Israel.
Wait, is the show done already? Is this show done?
Why? Is there more?
Anything else you want to talk about, Jack? Be my guest.
That's it. I think we covered everything.
Yeah, we lost the whole audience when you started talking about Coco.
Sorry.
Bregoli went back to sleep again.
I don't know. You know, all right, we can talk about one more thing if you want. The LA Film Critics just...
That's right.
Well, that is true. The LA Film Critics decided...
Call Me By Your Name,
Call Me By Your Name.
What are the New York Film
Critics... Which is really getting some momentum.
Did the New York Film Critics announce their thing yet?
Yeah,
the National Board of Review did.
Did the New York Film Critics...
Yeah, it did. The Film Critics Circle.
That's not the same as the New York.
Okay. Yeah.
What did they pick?
The Saoirse Ronan movie.
The what? They picked Lady Bird. Bill McCuddy movie.
Yeah.
Which,
the one you hate.
For the 80th time, I like Lady Bird. I don't think it's the best movie of the year. Bill keeps tweeting, and then he's got all these dance paper out in the Hamptons, unlike Neil Rosen, who dislikes the movie. I like the movie. I just don't think it's the best movie of the year. But that's
what is the best movie of the year, in your opinion?
I think Laurie Metcalf is phenomenal in the movie.
Look,
and I love Saoirse Ronan.
I'm thrilled you're coming around.
No, I'm not coming around. I always said it's a decent movie.
I knew if we applied enough pressure, I knew if enough people said it was good, you'd agree with them.
The best movie of the year? I don't know. You know, we're going to do a special show where we're gonna do our 10 best and 10 worst, but I have not decided that yet at this particular point. What is your favorite movie of the year so far, Jack?
It's probably Call Me By Your Name.
Really?
Yeah.
So far for you?
I told you.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's right up there. I don't have I'm doing my top 10 tonight because they're asking for it at the New York Post. But
I would say, if you told me the top three movies, in my opinion, I would say it's Call Me By Your Name, Lady Bird, and I, Tonya.
Wow.
In that order. Shape of Water coming into my top five.
Now I'd put Shape of Water is a good movie. Yeah.
Great.
Good, not great.
Yeah.
It's no Pan's Labyrinth. By the way, I was at a party the other night with Guillermo del Toro, and he walked in with three cases of Padron tequila that they make for him, I guess, which is $400 a bottle. And he started pouring shots for everybody. Francis McDormand was there.
Cool.
It was a post Shape of Water party here in Manhattan.
I thought you were kidding.
No. That was a real party.
Because I asked around, and it says, I think Bill McCuddy was kidding about that.
No. That's a real party.
Well, I'm glad you get invited to these parties. Jack and I went to Burger King
this
week. We got the extra fries.
I'll sneak you into the party. I'll roll you into a rug. I'll carry you into the party.
Star Wars next week. Thanks for sitting around talking movies with us. We'll sit around talking movies with you next week. For me, Neil Rosen. For Bill Bregoli.
Stay awake next week,
everybody. Jack Rico.
Bill McCuddy on Twitter.
Yes, we can follow Jack Rico at the... he's eating some peanuts now.
I love this popcorn with fudge on it. Highly Relevant at showbizcafe.com.
Highly Relevant Podcast.
Yep.
Twitter, we can find you on Twitter at...
Jack Rico Official.
Okay, at Bill McCuddy, Bill Bregoli. One day you'll get on social media.
Don't follow me or I'll put out a restraining order.
I'm at Neil Rosen Apples and Star Wars next week.
Thanks. One last bonus thing. Your buddy Bill Gilbert Gottfried has a guest appearance in the Maisel TV.
Oh, yes, show.
The Magnificent Mrs. Maisel.
The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. He plays an MC at a club in 1958. There you go.
All right.
See you next week.